Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network. My name is Michael Johnston, and I am the host on this network. Today I have Dr. Muschert to discuss a new book titled Global Agenda for Social Justice 2 by Policy Press, published just this year, 2022. Welcome to the show, Dr. Muschert.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Johnston. However, please feel welcome to call me Glenn. No need to be so formal. Thank you.
All right. Excellent. And Glenn is a professor of sociology at Khalifa University of Science and Technology at Abu Dhabi. Today we will be, again, discussing the Global Agenda for Social Justice 2. And the first question I want to start off with is, what is it that sparked the interest in creating this edited version? My understanding is that it started off as originally as a U.S. social justice issue published in 2004. Is that accurate?
Yes, exactly. The overall series, the Agenda for Social Justice series, was inspired by the 1999 presidential address delivered by Professor Robert Perucci of Purdue University. He's now Professor Emeritus. He's a longtime member of the SSSP, the Society for the Study of Social Problems. And in his presidential address, he reminded the membership that we have gotten a bit academic in our pursuits and called us, in a way, it inspired us to move back to a more public sociology. After all, the Society for the Study of Social Problems was a branch off, or a group moved a bit away from the American Sociological Association, who they criticized for being a bit overly academic and not having as much practical applications for improvement of society. And so he was pointing the finger back at the group for exhibiting the same tendency that the American Sociological Association had exhibited. And so his call was for a public sociology that would capture the essence of pressing social problems, give the best information, most reliable information that is available for these problems, and then that would offer real concrete solutions to either reduce or eliminate these social problems moving forward. The original version was called the Agenda for Social Justice, published in 2004, self-published by the SSSP. And it was then repeated in 2008, 12, 16, and 2020. And these volumes became increasingly more polished and more ultimately, we have a partnership with Policy Press, which is an imprint of Bristol University Press in the UK, an academic publisher. And so now it's kind of really a real kind of proper published book series. So we got tied up with Bristol University Press or Policy Press because their acquisitions editor, the chief of acquisitions, Ms. Victoria Pittman, took a trip to the U.S. and attended the one of the SSSP meetings and had a conversation with me and wanted to lay out a bit of a partnership between this publisher and our association. And so in 2016, we published the first we published the first of our U.S. focused volumes with Policy Press. Somewhere in the next year or so, a conversation emerged around the topic of, well, 4 years is a long time to wait for a series. So is there something we can, we have any ideas for something to do in the middle? So in 2018, we published the first of our global agendas for social justice. And these are intended to come in between the U.S. ones. So we're publishing now every other year and alternating between U.S. focus, the timing of which coincides with major U.S. elections like presidential elections. And then in the in between, we're publishing the global focus ones. So this one that we're discussing today is the second of our global focus volumes, which we hope each of them makes an impact. However, we're also committed to building this series alternating between U.S. and global focus moving forward.
And most importantly, being public facing, as you started the conversation with, because as a Society for the Study of Social Problems, as an organization, it began as one that is public facing to present itself as something slightly different from ASA, correct?
Absolutely. The SSSP, in fact, its flagship journal, Social Problems, was always intended to offer concrete and real world solutions to studying real world social problems. It was never intended to be completely just theoretical or abstract. I was always intended to be have some sort of implied element.
And then part of that is being jargon free to reduce the I guess pompousness of, you know, jargon language that is understood maybe only by the ivory tower and maybe only used in the ivory tower.
Absolutely. Well, I call this one version of this language, this academic language, I call sociologies. And, you know, the last part of it is G's. And I think some people, when they read the books or the articles that are published by many professional social scientists, they say, oh, geez, this is just too dense. And I, you know, this isn't there something that we can read that would be rigorous and informed and have the basis in kind of academics, yet would be something that smart people can access. And that's the focus of our audience. We try, of course, the academicians can read the jargon free, and they can kind of see between the lines a bit that there are, that is, it's grounded in rigorous social science. However, at the same time, you know, many of the readers that we're also targeting in this public sociology are not as concerned with the finer details. And so basically we want to present the ideas to smart people who may not be experts in the fields. And, you know, think about like undergraduate students, graduate students, or even scholars who are working in different fields and may not be familiar with the focus of a specific topic that in a chapter. And then of course, also policy, people who are in social policy realms, right? We're sociology and other social science disciplines are at risk of being too esoteric, and policy people in the policy field don't necessarily have the time, the available time. They're obviously smart people, but may not have the available time to go deep dive into things as academicians have, you know, the resources to do. And so, and then finally, just the interested public around the world. These are social issues that affect many of them, millions or even billions of people. around the world. And so we want that to be jargon free. We want it to be as clear as possible. Certainly not like kind of dumbed down, as would be the term, right? But just sort of like, let's be a bit more direct and plain speaking. And the other thing is that, you know, English has, for good or bad, become the lingua franca, ironically, of academics for most of the world. And so we also have audience that is for whom English is a second language. And even if it's a working language, we also want to make sure that we're as clear as possible so everyone can understand what we're trying to say.
And that's the next thing that I wanted to get to is the inclusiveness of this edited version. I'm not surprised, but I am very happy to see and very glad to see that there are 32 different scholars from 8 different countries included in this edited version. What do you see the significance of?
Well, there's a big significance in that the inclusivity of the volume. Well, it's impossible to include all topics and all people from everywhere. However, that's the tendency and the goal. So mostly the topics are and the volumes are generated by the interests of the contributors. A call for papers goes out and it says we're looking for contributors, and we try to send it out as broadly as possible. So it goes out through various social science listservs and Facebook sites and various other forms of social media. And this includes, on my part, a specific attempt to send to basically go to the International Sociological Association, ask them to publicize our call for papers or call for proposals. But then also I go to pretty much every, there's a list of every sociology, social science association worldwide. And I will personally send an email to the administrative office or to the president or vice president, whoever is the, sometimes all of them, and say, here's our call for papers. We would love to have, scholars contributing from, say, the Albanian Sociology Society or Albanian Sociology Association, like, you know, the other ASA, right? frequently we get folks. And I personally am based in the Middle East. So I came up through the discipline in the US, worked for 16 years at Miami University. And then in 2019, I just decided to up and move and came to the Middle East, where I'm happily based. But it has led to a really vast expansion in my network. So I have a lot of colleagues in various countries, from Africa to South Asia to the Middle East and so on. And so I send it out to these folks, or they see the posting on my social media. I don't want to make it sound like I'm famous and I know everybody, but, you know, I have a several thousand who follow my Twitter. And so you can imagine that there's several hundred who probably see that and frequently retweet and so on.
And just being able to have that connection on, you know, multiple continents. So being able to make those connections, I think that, having that line from the United States to the Middle East has helped you better connect and has made this edited version better because of those connections.
I do hope so, yes.
And so there were 11 different topical areas for social justice in this edited version. Did those emerge naturally, or were they decided prior to the call for papers?
Those emerged in an organic way. So the call for papers goes out, and the potential contributors will then submit their proposals. Our editorial committee will review all of the proposals and then ultimately select the ones that are that are the strongest, that may have the highest impact. there is some small level at which we do say, oh, we would really love to have something on a massive problem like climate change or you know, the white nationalism or something like that, if for whatever volume, and these seem to be like kind of a right of Black Lives Matter, for example, Me Too movement. Like these are things that we see like as very current and not, you know, current movements, but sort of based on underlying sociological issues and conflicts. And so sometimes we'll issue a small number of invites to people in these areas. If we'll wait to see, we hope that they'll come in. But we say, well, how can we publish a global something that doesn't have some at least one chapter on climate change, right? And so then if something comes in organically, then we'll snatch it and hold on to it. And if it doesn't, then we'll issue a small number of direct invitations to people in that field or in that area of study.
And the cool part about this is that the local national news would potentially suggest that there's no way that there's room for 11 different social justice matters, and to give this time to speak about these social justice issues that the news maybe won't even bat an eye at or only give a short blurb to, you know, adds to the conversation that otherwise might not be had.
I agree. One thing I would like to point out is that we make no claim that we are comprehensive. So the 11 topics that we cover can hardly encompass all of the potential topics and social problems that we would like to discuss. So we make no claim to cover everything and everything to be like an exhaustive encyclopedia of social problems. On the other hand, and we are limited to who we can get on board to contribute and work with us. That's a self-selected group, but oftentimes it's a really great, high-quality self-selected group. And it does bring to light some topics that may not be at, you know, the news media has various ways that people have discussed it, like the issue attention cycle, which is a very old concept. But, you know, but we see it as like, okay, something happens and then the media kind of helicopter in or parachute in, they cover something like a disaster, and then they're out because another earthquake happened somewhere else, or another bombing happened somewhere else, or another extrajudicial police killing happened somewhere else, right? And so they don't necessarily focus on something. Take for example, like Black Lives Matter. The issue is emergent at every repetition of a person of color being brutalized illegally or even killed in police custody. However, the underlying issue is hardly new, right? This sort of like devaluation of Black and brown bodies and the police as an agent of the state that has a history in policing kind of racial segregation and those kinds of things. It's hardly new. So we're trying to have a middle ground here where it's a focus on an issue that it's not a journal. We aren't journalists because we don't just kind of have to play to the daily audience or the weekly audience as journalists might do. We our audience are people who have a bit of a deeper, longer lasting concern for social issues. And I think that's a kind of a middle ground. One of the things I would talk about is that our group at the SSSP also has a series. We published rapid response volumes. And so as we all got locked down around the world in 2020, the first half of 2020, everybody was sitting at home and the conversation was going around with many people saying, I don't want to just sit here. Like, how can I use my skills to help? And so we contacted University of Bristol or Bristol University Press or Policy Press, and we discussed, hey, what is the possibility to produce a rapid response volume? And so we issued a call for papers for social justice. We issued a call for papers for a volume on social problems in the age of COVID-19. And we said, how quickly can we get this out? So, you know, rather than having everybody just like write something overnight and then put it on a blog, we said, what's the fastest that we can do an academic volume? And so what we did is we issued a call for papers, and within 6 weeks, we had gotten the proposals invited, submitted, reviewed, asked for revisions, and so on. In 6 weeks, we submitted a volume to Policy Press, and within about 5 or 6 weeks, they were able to do everything that they do on their end, and we published an online, an ebook version within about 12 weeks from the inception of the idea to the end. And when we issued the call for papers, we had well over 100, if I remember correctly, it was somewhere up about 125 proposals. So we were able to select really from the best of this. It was a high number of proposals. Then the conversation came about like, well, we have some that are US focused and some that are global, and we actually split it off into two volumes. So there's a Social Problems in the Age of COVID-19, Volume 1 and Volume 2, both published in 2020 and both part of this rapid response project. And so to have an academic book that has time to go through the process of kind of vetting the submissions, editing the submissions, revising, and then goes to an academic publisher for their proper value add that they provide on their end. Within 12 weeks to have it available and come to market, that was about as fast as it gets, in my opinion. It's hardly possible to move much quicker than that.
We're reaffirming the social element of the Social Problems Organization and how important sociology and the social sciences are to even medical related issues like COVID-19 was. And without that front facing, without that social justice element that exist with Society for the Study of Social Problems, I don't know that the same would occur in other organizations.
That's possibly true. I mean, this is the SSSP has been my intellectual home, and I have really enjoyed the aspect of it where the people are all not just interested in kind of being in the ivory tower and navel gazing, but also have a strong interest in applying the knowledge. And many of the people are also activists and or work in policy areas as well,
which is part of the mission statement and what Society for the Study of Social Problems presents themselves as, making it no secret at all.
Exactly. Yeah, the other thing that I've always loved about the SSSP and this project as well is that the people are a little bit less concerned with status sorting than those in other places I've visited. So, for example, I will sit down, Robert Perucci, who inspired this overall project. He's a great example. Was publishing in ASR back in the 1960s, so he's kind of a living legend in our field. And to this day, he'll just sit down and talk to you, anybody. It doesn't really matter. And so it's kind of how I came into it. Here I was, a doctoral student back in the late 1990s, and go to go to the SSSP meetings and here are these people like, you know, big names. Dorothy Smith was a member, Robert Perucci, Joel Best. These are people who like kind of we read as undergraduates and graduate students and we kind of, you know, revere. And so I just sit down with Robert Perucci and he says, like, you know, the first thing he asks you is like, you know, what are you working on? Like, what are your ideas? You given a paper? What's your paper about? Right. He doesn't say like, who are you? Where are you from? What's your rank? What's your status? You know, who's your advisor? He doesn't say any of that stuff. What have you done for me lately? He doesn't. He just says, what are you working on now? And what is the, you know, what's it about? And he wants to hear it. And I've seen him have conversations with anybody from, you know, the person who's like the former president of the ASA to an undergraduate student and everywhere in between. So it's one of the beauties of the ethos, I suppose, of our group. And so among these 32 scholars around the world, we also have people who have positions in various ranks. So we have people who, the person who wrote our foreword was the former president of the International Sociological Association. We have others who have been highly respected for decades. However, we also have many students. We have junior professors. We also have people who work in policy areas and policy positions, activist positions. And so I think we can also be proud that we have a rather eclectic group that shows how much interest there is about the social problems and their solutions at all ranks of academics, from different fields, from people who work in policy, from people who are possibly in like kind of advocacy positions and those kinds of things. So it's really, I look at the series and each volume as a conversation. And as the editor, I look at myself as the convener of this conversation. My job is to bring the people together in a productive way, and then as much as I can to support and guide. But largely, if it's moving forward in a positive way, which it can be in a multiplicity of directions as well, could be positive. I just sort of stand aside and let people work. I kind of over the years, I think, really enjoy editing because it's about helping the person or the people who are writing their piece to reach the full potential of the impact of what they're attempting to write. And I think that if they understand that you're not asking them to do revisions because you want to make it difficult or you want to, to be in a position of power, but rather you're asking this for reasonable, you know, you can point out like, look, this piece already has promise, but it hasn't reached its full impact yet. And if you did this list of things, then this piece would have a much, much stronger impact and would reach a greater potential. And so, you know, there is an aspect of editing that involves taking people and sort of taking these pieces that people propose or contribute and deciding whether they have the quality and whether they're of a level that we would like to publish. But beyond that, it's largely a matter of trying to get the best out of, to encourage the people to do the best, to get the best out of their work with the whatever time they have available. And also on our side as editors, we have limited time as well. So sometimes we can't do everything. But the other thing is that making sure that the contributions fit. In terms of academics, we're largely accustomed to writing articles, academic articles for journals, and the academic article is self-contained. So it stands on its own. I mean, it fits a certain topic, whether it's just, you know, Americans Journal of Sociology or whatever. It fits the topic that is sociology, but it doesn't have to relate to any of the other articles in there. Well, when we have a book and we think about our readers will like to have a book where there's some coherence to it. It's not just a kind of a collection of standalone things, but there's some sort of thread that runs through them all. And so that's a challenge that we have sometimes, is to sort of communicate in a supportive way to the authors that we really need you to conform to a certain kind of overall format and style and such, right? And to encourage them along those lines. Probably one of the biggest challenges we have is that our pieces, our topical pieces in the volume, have three sections. And the three sections are a problem statement, sort of a definition of what is the problem. The second is a definition or kind of an overview of what we know about the problem. This would be looking at various kind of ways of understanding it and data forms that can help us to understand the nature and the extent of the problem. And then finally, to talk about solutions. And one of the challenges is that we want the solutions to be about half of each chapter. And so so social scientists are very good at providing information. So the early drafts that we often receive have a, you know, talk about the problem and here's what the problem and then, oh, here's all the data and here's more data and here's some more data on top of that. And then at the end, often the solutions seem to be like kind of like the last point, right? But they're just kind of tacked on at the end. And so what we are, our approach is to say, like, look, if you're talking about something like health inequalities or educational inequalities or say violence or racism, you know, I think that the pitfall for many social scientists is that they think that if you provide more information, then it's better. And I think we said, like, no, we want to concentrate on solutions. So if you can't sort of define the problem and give the major sources of data about the problem in a way, you know, if the people don't care or apathetic or, you know, giving them more data won't help them become care about this issue. But, you know, for the people who are like, okay, yeah, here's a problem, I'm interested. And then here's the definition, here's the data. And then we move into this area where it's like, here are the possible solutions. Then you know, that's what our audience wants. And I learned this in a way through teaching classes, social problems classes for years. Because, you know, not every, but most universities will have a course in social problems, and it's typically offered at like kind of the, you know, 200 level, right? And it's kind of a survey course and all. Well, I heard feedback from my students that social problems class was like, you know, like the most depressing class that they ever took, because it's like, okay, hey, guess what, students? This week we're talking about like homelessness, and, you know, and then they're like, ooh, that's terrible, you know, and then, well, wait till next week when we talk about like, you know, violence, you know what I mean? And then the next week we'll talk about drug problems and, you know, and so on. So by the end of like 15 weeks, the students are depressed and thinking the world is awful, right? And I thought, boy, that's really not a good instructional tactic, but it's also not what we want to convey to our students, who are, you know, generally at the earlier stages of life and optimistic and enthusiastic and such. So at the very beginning of our volume here, you know, we often use the Marx's one of his theses, the statement from the thesis of Feuerbach, which is, you know, the philosophers heretofore have only studied society, the point is to change it. And that forced me to think about like how I was leaving my students in the lurch. saying like I'm activating them and they care, but they actually become more apathetic when they care, but then there's nothing they can do about it. And so we see the onus on us as kind of the communicators in this social problems realm is to activate people by telling them that problems exist and you know, defining them and such, but then also to put forward some solutions that whether they're on a micro level, what individuals can do on a community level, on a national level or whatever, but to say that these problems are there, but remember that they're socially constructed, meaning that people made them. And so therefore there is inherently the potential that people can also solve or eliminate these social problems as well if we were to change what we're doing.
And then also to know that we have an audience who don't really need convincing that there is a problem that exists. So why continue to spend most of the article showing data when really what's the important piece, as with, you know, for students as well in that social problems course, they're like, yeah, quit giving me all of these problems. You know, what's the solution? And I don't want to wait till the end of the course to get just a glimpse of light, because that's about all that many of these social problems books provide in the last chapter, is a glimpse of light that might work out. But based on how much time we spent talking about problems, I don't know that our students are very confident, and I don't know that I'm very confident by the end of the semester either.
So this is related to our contributors in a way. Many of the problems that in many cases the solutions proposed tend to be a bit either too specific or to be too expansive. So in the case of solutions being too specific, oftentimes they'll say, this policy ABC is something that we should do everywhere. And even worldwide, we should do policy ABC. And we sort of attempt to get our contributors to back off that oftentimes to say like a policy like such and such, a policy that has aspects of such, but also note that, you know, even within the United States, you would have, does a certain policy work for all areas of the United States, right? You have to, you can't really say that a single policy will work in Los Angeles, downtown LA at the same time and way that it works on, say, like the Navajo lands and, the northern slope of Alaska or, the Virgin Islands. It gets even more so worldwide. So we sort of have to think about the different, that sort of like the generality of policies. The second thing is that we oftentimes get solutions that are a bit too grandiose. So let's end capitalism, or let's end patriarchy, let's abolish prisons, right? And I mean, these might be like kind of good like end points to work towards in some ways. However, what we want to convey is that we have a real kind of short to medium term relevancy. And that if you put these policies in, a certain type of policy, then it's going to help in X way. And it's been demonstrated through follow-up studies and such. Right. And so we try to get the contributors to spend half of their time on the solutions and then to spend all of that time looking at really kind of more practical, achievable types of things. Now, it's not that I personally would object to something such as like, let's end patriarchy, right? So I'm not saying I have a personal or intellectual opposition to this. I'm just saying that, we sometimes run the risk of being labeled by our people who disagree with us as being like kind of too pie in the sky and kind of unrealistic. So, you know, what would be like concrete steps that we could take to reduce or eliminate patriarchy would be a better answer as far as we're generally concerned than would be like just burn the whole house down sort of thing, you know.
And this is the same approach for both edited versions, right? Both the U.S. social justice issue the global agenda for social justice.
Absolutely. And we also have a limitation, which is that, you know, the SSSP is a not-for-profit organization. And so we cannot advocate for any for or against any political candidate party. We also cannot advocate or lobby for or against any specific legislation or policies. So we run that risk if we did of being losing this not-for-profit status that the that is beneficial to the organization. And we do so by kind of hedging and saying a type of policy that we would like to see would be this. And then you could say, for example, here's one of them, right? But not saying like House Bill number, you know, 110, right? We're for or against, but, you know, saying that the type of goals that could be achieved by this type of policy are the ones that we would recommend happening around the different states, countries, national governments, and so on.
All right. So, yeah, one of the questions that I had is a call for papers. If our audience members wanted to contribute to this upcoming U.S. social justice issue, when could they expect that to come out, and where might they find that at?
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. And the more interest we can generate, the better, in my opinion. So we already are in the very early stages of planning a 2024 volume, which will have a U.S. focus. And we issue a call for papers probably January 2023 and February 2023. And so folks can find that definitely if you're a member of the SSSP, goes out on the SSSP listserv, on the social media for the SSSP. I will also post it on undoubtedly on my social media, and I'll send it out via various listservs and Facebook sites and so on for professional associations and so on.
And you also mentioned other ways to get involved, like in rapid response with COVID-19. But my understanding is that there is another upcoming rapid response in 2023 that will be released. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's totally accurate. We already are actually planning to launch a rapid response volume on the topic of mass incarceration to be published about August of 2023. And so this is looking at the 50-year mark, so to speak, of this age of mass incarceration in the United States. So if we go back to 1973, this was the beginning of what they called the Rockefeller drug laws passed by the New York State, and which resulted in frequently in urban populations, say in like New York City, many of them black and brown, being incarcerated at length for drug offenses. And so many of us look at this as kind of like the beginning of this age of mass incarceration. And so 2023 would mark the 50 years of that. And so it's time for us to get our opinions in there and to discuss any number of issues about mass incarceration or related, such as the effects on communities, the disenfranchisement of people with felonies, and you know, maybe like reentry problems, recidivism, effects on recidivism, and you know, child welfare, you know, the effect it has on families and things like that. So the call for papers for that should go out in the next couple months, actually. So we're talking October, November of 2022. And so it would be a very quick timeline where the pieces would be submitted for publication in less than a year. So by August of 2023.
Excellent. And are there any other ways that you would suggest or maybe even throw out for audience members to get involved in other publications or other opportunities that are associated with SSSP or even, you know, this publication?
Well, the publication is, you know, if anyone ever has any suggestions about how we can reach a greater audience or how we can find more and different and new contributors, I'm happy to explore that. Happy to hear suggestions. In terms of the SSSP, you know, to become a member is the probably the first. Our volumes are available as a part of the membership benefit. So our volumes are free for SSSP members. It's not a money making type of endeavor. They're also available at you know, at a reasonable cost, if people were to buy them. We generally are very at SSSP very welcoming of new members in particular. Every year at our conferences, we have a new member breakfast where we get some people who have been around for a while and specifically go and try to have breakfast and have conversations with some of the new members. Some of them visitors from around the world, some of them students who are just in the early stages of getting involved and so on. But we have actually a great need for volunteerism in our organization. So there are a lot of posts, in terms of maybe, just a lot of committees and a lot of ways that people can make a contribution. Probably the best way is that we have these divisions, which focus on specific topic areas like community development, crime and delinquency, drugs and alcohol, and so on. And to attend the business meetings for these is probably the grassroots way to get involved, because that's where they plan certain sessions, they plan what the groups are going to be doing, and so on. And I think sometimes I see some people say, like, they may be afraid that they have to have a certain position. Like, do I have to have a PhD or do I have to have a faculty position or do, you know, whatever to get involved? And the answer is no. I mean, we have people who are undergraduates who have been very involved as well. And so it's something that I recommend. And for students in particular to join, it's actually very inexpensive. That's one of the benefits of the SSSP is that we deliberately keep the fee, the membership fee very low for undergraduates. Not only undergraduates, but students in general. Yes.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to, you know, this is only the beginning of our discussion on Global Agenda for Social Justice. My plan is with this series is to continue moving through the book, you know, starting at the front with our conversation today, Glenn, and then continuing to talk to contributors who wrote pieces and that were published in this book. So really, the story is only starting today, and it will continue forward, hopefully talking to somebody about, you know, once every week, once every other week, and really getting this conversation out to the masses. And I look forward to continuing this conversation well into the future, not only with the Global Agenda for Social Justice too, but also future publications of this of this book and also to U.S. social justice issues, which will be out in a couple of years.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I would like to compliment you, Michael, on your role here in bringing what we do, not only my project, but the projects of the publications of many others in our field, to bringing it to a wider audience. I think to move into new media forms and to look for audiences, to engage them where they live, in this case in the podcast sphere, is the way that we should be going. And so thank you so much for your series and for welcoming me, and in particular I'll thank you in advance for the discussions with your contributors for our volume.
Thank you again. This is another episode of New Books in Sociology. Again, New Books in Sociology is a channel on the New Books Network. Have a great day.
Thank you so much.